it in our hands to have a good look at it, you know. But later on when we go home, then you can put it in a place as will be described, the way to kind of hang the thing in front of you, where to put it, etc. But at the moment then, if you could just keep it kind of handy so that when you can look at it from time to time, no need to keep it, you know, just on your lap or something, just keep it, you know, wherever's clean, so that from time to time you can pick it up and look at it, stare at it, to get the image kind of clearly imprinted, if you like, within your mind's eye. And that will be then the image we are going to focus upon. For last weekend, that we began the introduction to meditation with the foundation of mindfulness. So it's this foundation then which we're going to build on in this then, the second of the kind of meditation courses. And this, what I'm going to do today, is touch on then the elementary stages of shamatha meditation or calm abiding meditation. And so hopefully you'll have enough things to practice and to become familiar with. And so next year we can really kind of curb or really get to grips with then the practice of shamatha meditation in and of itself, which will then serve as the basis for our future investigation of the teaching of the Buddha. Now then, there's been some questions about the various sources, the scriptural sources which I'm using for the teaching of the Buddha, for the teaching of meditation. And so if you're interested in such things, then I will give you the sources now. In terms of the learning of the practice of a shamatha, of mindfulness is concerned, there is then the Sutta of Mindfulness from the Pali tradition, Satipatthana Sutta, and there's a few of those in varying sizes. Thereupon there is the kind of modern day interpretation by such masters as Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho from the Thai forest tradition, also by Thich Nhat Hanh from the Vietnamese Mahayana tradition. And in addition to that, there is then the path, which is known as the path of purification, which is one of the top kind of, or if not the authoritarian or authoritative manual on the Theravadan practice of meditation and mindfulness. And then from the Tibetan sources, in terms of the practice of meditation, there is the instructions of Tsongkhapa in the great exposition of the stages of the path. Then there is Tsongkhapa's middle-length stages of the path. Then there are the songs of Milarepa and their various interpretations. There are the meditation instructions of Padamba Sangye, the meditation instructions of the Tibetan translator Vimalamitra, the instructions of the Indian seer or meditation master Vimalamitra, and then there are then the kind of oral instructions which I've received from my teachers. Primarily His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Kevji Demalojo Rinpoche, Geshe Wangchen, Kimbo Yishi Gyaltsen, and Kevji Trulshi Rinpoche. So that should keep you busy. Then in terms of the sadhana here, the treasury of blessing, then I received teaching on this from many people, from Tukul Pema Wangyal, from Kimbo Yishi Gyaltsen, from Kevji Trulshi Rinpoche, and from Shishin Rabjan Rinpoche. And this commentary, which I'm going to be reading from, is composed by the 18th century master called Mipham, Ju Mipham. And this was put together and finalized by Kyabji Dingo Kenzo Rinpoche. So this book, which I'm reading from now, there is a translation of it, which I'll try and get for you. It's not been published yet. But this is basically an abbreviation of a huge work by Mipham, which is on the subject of shamatha and vipassana. So this was kind of brought down or kind of cut down so as to be practically applicable or handy, if you like, a meditation manual by Kevji Dingo Kenzo Rinpoche and one of Kevji Rinpoche's principal disciples, Tukul Sangak Tenzin, made an even more abbreviated version of this, particularly for his students in America. And so when that's, it's been translated by a friend of mine, Jules Levinston. So this will be available shortly, so I'll try and get you an advanced copy of that when it's done. In terms of looking at the biography of the Buddha, then I'm relying on the Pali sources by Bhikkhu Niyapoli, then the Sanskrit manuscript
and the Tibetan translation by Lubun Thayang, called then The Acts of the Buddha. In addition to that, then an abbreviation of the 12 Deeds of the Buddha by Kyabje Dingo Kenzi Rinpoche, a poem which goes through then the 12 Deeds of the Buddha by Shabka Tsogdo Rangdu. And the kind of beginning part of the session, and also the first part of tomorrow's session, I'll be relying on the outline of the Swift Path by the second Panchen Lama, Panchen Losa Yeshe. So for those of you who are interested in books, that's more than enough to be getting along with. And now kind of returning to sanity, somewhat, then let's get on with the job at hand, which is then to learn simply about then the practice of meditation without all the need for all this kind of elaboration, but really just simply to learn how to initially then develop a state of mind or meditation which is at one point focused, clear, and at the same time relaxed. So as you remember from what we went through last weekend, when developing then the practice of mindfulness, we need them to make our kind of bodies serviceable. So just to kind of run through then the 7-point posture of Vairochana, just to kind of refresh your kind of mind, so as you can sit comfortably in the posture, because the effect that the physical posture has on the mind and thereby the meditation is really quite dramatic. I mean, we can even see this after having eaten a kind of very heavy lunch, then we feel immediately very, very sluggish when it comes to sitting in meditation. Likewise, if we haven't eaten for a very, very long time, when we have initial kind of stomach cramps start, if we try to concentrate on the breath or to sit comfortably and develop a sense of being in the present moment, of meditating on the breath, for example, again, that becomes something really rather difficult. So as in all things Buddhist, we hear of this middle way, rather like kind of Goldilocks' porridge, for those of you who know then the nursery rhyme or the children's story. Neither too hot nor too cold, rather just right. So in the same way, we don't want to be too relaxed so as we fall asleep, but on the other hand, we don't want to be too kind of tight so that we feel mentally distracted. So rather sitting comfortably, either on a chair with your feet kind of flat, grounded in the earth, or if you're sitting cross-legged on the floor, either in the kind of cross-legged posture, the full lotus posture, where you have the thigh, the foot on the opposite thigh, or whether you're sitting in the half lotus posture, or the cross-legged posture, or the Burmese posture, where you have one calf in front of another, whatever. You should be grounded. That is to say then, like a tripod, if you remember the example where you have the two knees and the backside functioning like a tripod, grounding the camera. So here we are grounding our kind of torso, grounding our being in this kind of tripod. So as such, if you need to kind of, if you feel a tightness in your legs through the kind of hamstrings or through the hips being too closed, then please prop yourself up with pillows and cushions, etc., so as that you remain kind of stable. Because what you don't want to be is distracted by thoughts of running, needing a cushion halfway through the session and thereby ruining it for yourself by having to get up and find a cushion or a pillow. So look, if you need them, kind of get hold of them now. And that's the first point, then, being grounded in one's legs. The second point of these 7 points, then, the torso should be erect. Spine should be straight, like a stack of Chinese coins, one atop the other. Lift up the chest, opening the lungs. Lift up the sternum. Roll the shoulders. Remember, to gauge where your arms should go, you kind of put your arms loosely in front of your forearms. Roll your shoulders back. Just allow the hands fold into then the meditation posture, the right hand on top of the left hand, or if that's uncomfortable, again, roll your shoulders back as you do that, opening up the top part of the chest so as to allow then the full usage of the lungs, and then just put your hands forward and allow it to gently fall to the knees. Either way is all right. So that's position 3 and 4, 3 for the shoulders, 4 for the hands in the lap. And the fifth point then is just to tuck the chin slightly in. Remember, not too far, just right, so that what you're feeling is pushing forward, as if you're kind of pushing the back of your skull, just forward ever so slightly. And be mindful of the effect that has on the upper portion of the spine going into the skull. That should straighten up, causing the final elongation of the spine. And the sixth point is to then plaster your tongue along the roof of the mouth, along the palate. The tip of it then should come to rest behind the upper row of teeth. If you find that there's any saliva between the tongue and the roof of the mouth, and just kind of suck it and kind of either spit it out or kind of swallow it. And then the eyes, remember? Just allow then the eyelids just to fall together, allowing that tiny opening. We're not squinting and we're not trying to look out of our eyes. We are just keeping the senses alert, functioning. We're not starting then the shutdown process which occurs when we close our eyes. We're not ushering in a dullness of mind through then shutting the mind. And we're also not keeping our eyes open wide. For if our eyes at this stage in our practice are wide open, we will certainly be distracted by the movements in the room, the colors in the room, the forms in the room, etc. So again, neither open nor closed. So somewhere in between. Just having the eyes slightly open. That's the position we want to find ourselves in. And then just let us relax in the moment. Let us utilize then the instructions of mindfulness, particularly the mindfulness of breathing that we learned last weekend. So again, place your attention at the inner tip of the nose, which is the point where the air enters the nostrils. And before turning back and going up then the bridge of the nose into the sinus, etc., there's a tingling sensation at the inner tip of the nose. If you identify the outer tip, then exactly behind there, the inner tip of the nose, just observe as you breathe gently in and out, without forcing or reducing the breath. As you breathe, and just notice the sensation. And just be with it for a while. Remember, we're going to use the breath to counter or oppose or deal with any of the potential problems we may have in the meditation. So if we're feeling very tired, then we place our attention at this inner tip of the nose. However, if we're feeling very scattered, very spaced out, the continual barrage of thoughts taking us here, there and everywhere, and place your attention into the air, to the abdomen, and then search for and notice, without forcing it, the rising and the falling of the diaphragm, and ground yourself in its rising and falling. So, whatever you need, utilize that this time. If you feel that you're a little tired, look at the nose. If you're a little scattered, spaced out, then use the diaphragm. Okay, we're not trying to cause ourselves to be agitated, we're just observing the gentle flow of the breath. And then, as you remember from last weekend, let me just relax in the moment. Release the meditation. Open your eyes wide. Before jumping up and going about any activity, it's important then to create a cool down period, if you like. If we've been working out heavily in the gym, we don't just jump into the shower or kind of run off to the office. We allow ourselves a moment to cool down. So in the same way, when we finished our intense meditation session, so as to bring the experience of meditation into the non or the between meditation period, then it's essential that we kind of cool off, if you will. So for this example is using Longchenpa's Resting in the Nature of Mind book or meditation instructions. It's like putting down a heavy burden. Just feel that sense of relaxation or mindfulness permeate your being. And just rest with it, sit with it. And so, when we finally do get up from our meditation cushions and seats, and we go about our day-to-day business, it's as all the meditation instructions say, that progress in meditation is made by how we conduct ourselves when we are not meditating. For example, if we're doing a retreat and we practice meditation for, let's say, 4 2-hour periods a day, then in those periods where we're not meditating, if we engage in all manner of activity, it can bring absolute ruin to our meditation practice so that we can't make any progress therein. And so as such, it's imperative to get used to or get in the habit or the way of allowing then the meditation, the session or the experience thereof to permeate one's being so that it becomes one. Because as mentioned, meditation is not something kind of magical or mystical. It's something very organic, very grounded, very natural. And then to allow that experience to occur, we should give it then the kind of breathing space and the breathing space here then is this cooling off period to allow then the actual experience of meditation to merge with or to mix with who we are. Which brings us to then the subject of tonight's topic, which is going into the practice of meditation. So I'm reading from then the outline of then a book which are known then as the experiential kind of instructions on the graduated stages of the path to enlightenment. And this is primarily based upon a book called The Path to Bliss, of which there is a translation of a commentary by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the present Dalai Lama. Although the book itself was written by the first Panchen Lama, it's a very brief book. So this is a commentary on that by the second Panchen Lama, Lhotse Yeshe. So I'm just looking at the outline, not at the book itself. Now when we practice meditation seriously, and of course here we're taking it as the ideal where we're in a retreat setting, where we kind of cut off ties to our kind of worldly life and we're going away to practice seriously for a period of time. So some individuals in Tibet would have used this as their life's instructions, whereas others would have used it for a weekend. So whether we're doing it for life or whether we're just doing it just now and again, or for us in our kind of busy and hectic lifestyles, even if we're only going to meditate for a little while every day, either in the morning or in the evening, whatever the case may be, then it's imperative to utilize these 6 points or these 6 instructions, whether in a lifestyle changing way in the case of an individual who's in a lifelong retreat, or in the case then of somebody who is just meditating for 5 minutes. All of these things are extremely important. And so if you can memorize these or know these 7 points, 6 points rather, so that they come to mind every time you think of practicing meditation, then the meditation session itself would flow very, very easily. So, first of all, is sitting in a place which is conducive, a nice place, if you will. Seems rather straightforward, doesn't it? But really, what does a nice place mean, a conducive place? Well, we can look at the various kind of contributory factors for establishing meditation. A quiet place, some place which is open, possibly. Place that's nicely decorated, not too hot, not too cold, not too hard perhaps for our seat, not too soft. Whatever we think is necessary to bring about then the state of meditation, it doesn't mean that we have to, you know, put up lots of images as we see in the kind of temples in Asia. It doesn't mean that we also have to kind of throw out anything nice that we might have and be a kind of be rather in a sparse environment, rather like a zendo or a kind of Chinese meditation hut or cell. We know what they look like. We've seen images on the television, we've seen photographs in picture books, etc. But here, as this is something very private, and we want to practice meditation, we should sit in a place which is conducive to our own meditation. What might be right for me possibly would really intrigue you and thereby distract you from the meditation. Perhaps it would upset you, making you want to kind of run away from the environment. So here, this is something which is very personal and it's something which is individual. However, there are some common elements. It should be a place that is inspiring for us. As such, some people like to put images of the Buddha, as we see here, to inspire them. Others like to put photographs of their teachers. Not like a little child puts a picture of a pop star or of a movie star, being a fan. Rather, an image of a teacher is put there as a source of inspiration. When we look at that individual, we should at least think, I would like to be like they are. I would like to have their qualities. It should inspire one to want to practice the spiritual path that said individual or said spiritual master embodies. So whomever that may be, of course this is something very personal. It's something very private. But nevertheless, if we need or if we like to use those images as a source of inspiration, then by all means we should do that. And utilizing this sadhana or this meditation manual, the Treasury of Blessings, is the one within which we are going to meditate or use as our focus an image of the Buddha. So in your kind of collection of bits and bobs that you have in that package, there's a beautiful image of the Buddha. So later on, if you would like to use that, if you'd like to erect that image, which would be very, very useful, then so be it. For example, in Tibetan language, the word for such images, whether they be photographs, statues, or these paintings here, is den, which means support, a support for one's meditation. Don't be under the assumption, though, that we're going to meditate by just staring at it. That would just give us a headache. Here, we just use it as a support for our meditation until we can go beyond that. So, again, if you would like to put such an image up and use it as a source of inspiration as well as the focal object of one's meditation, then great. Some people like to put flowers, various kinds of nice things, scented waters, incense, etc., in front of them, such images. This is all creating the atmosphere within which we can really practice meditation. That's what it's for. So when you, in this first point, when you are kind of making an area within which you are going to meditate, it should be one which is personally conducive for you, a place that you kind of feel comfortable in. For when we practice meditation, we don't want to be uncomfortable, do we? We don't want to kind of think of it rather like a child thinks of school, where all we can think of is school. Yeah, want to go the other way. So here, our place of meditation, our practice room or cell or corner of our bedsit, wherever it may be, so be a place which is nice, conducive in the sense of being kind of airy. Our cushion should be neither too hard nor too soft, something which is just right for us. It should be open. If we would like to put these various offerings and sources of inspiration, then so be it. The second point is to be without kind of desire. What does that mean? So here, desire doesn't just mean kind of desires of the flesh, as it were, but rather desire for particularities with regard then experience and with regard then the place we find ourselves in. In terms of experience, that comes later. Here then, we should just sit down where we are and be without the thought that, oh, maybe I just need one more picture. Maybe I just need another bowl of flowers. Maybe I just need this. All the kind of distractions which would lead us then away from our meditation. Wishing to have this, wishing to have that, not being satisfied with this, not being satisfied with that, etc. This isn't good enough. This should be like this, etc. If we're so hung up on the outer surroundings, then chances are we're not really going to look inside because we're too distracted by what is going on around us. So it is, as it is said then, when we sit down to meditate, we should be perfectly in the moment without kind of being without the distraction of what's around, of being either too indulgent or too frugal with what is surrounding us. We should set up our, we should have set up our seating area, we should set up our kind of place to do the practice of meditation, and then without the wish for anything, being without any idea of needing anything more, without being needy, if you like, then we just sit down to do the practice. And if any of those thoughts arise, then the third point of being content should kick in. That is to say, we should train ourselves to being content with whatever we have. So if we set up everything and we sit down and thoughts start to bombard us, this isn't right, that isn't right, should do this, should do that, then just let it go. As we were training in the mindfulness of the thought process, just sit there, and if those thoughts proliferate, just let them go, relax, and be content in the present moment with what you have and where you are. So it's essential then to have, to be content. For it is only within this contented framework, contented state of mind, if you will, that we are going to make any progress in meditation. There are many stories in India about contentment being like the wish-granting jewel, or the contentment being that which is, you know, beyond purchasing. That is to say, if we have contentment, we've no need for anything. And this state of mind is not something which can be bought, but rather is something which is developed from within. So as such then, if we develop this contentment, so much so that whatever happens, we're just going to meditate for however long we've given over to the practice of meditation, regardless of what happens, we're just going to sit back and remain content in the moment, in the present moment of then our meditation, for as long as we've given over to the practice of meditation. Which leads us to the fourth point, is to give up all manner of activity. That is to say, if we are going to meditate from 8 to 9, let's say, then that's what we should do. We shouldn't be doing other activities. That means we should leave our mobile phone, our BlackBerry, iPad, all these kind of things that we usually kind of keep very close to us, because when we're sitting down, perhaps our mind becomes somewhat clearer. And at that point we think, oh, I should have SMS'd so-and-so. Well, I'll just do it quickly, it won't matter. If we give in once, give in twice, a third time, a fourth time, and before we know it, our meditation session will be, just become one big SMS fest, if you like. Or, you know, one big kind of email fest. So here, the notion that when we are actually practicing meditation, whether it be for the intensity of the time frame or during the cool down period, we're just going to focus on meditation without any excuses. We don't make excuses, for example, if we are practicing another form of discipline, yoga, for example, karate, kickboxing, boxing. If we're practicing any of those things, we can't just, in the middle of the game, say, hang on a minute, I have to SMS somebody. We could get quite hurt. So in the same way, when we're practicing meditation, then we just leave aside all of these activities. Perhaps turn the telephone off. Perhaps leave it in a different room. I remember when, having been several times in Southeast Asia, where translating or giving a talk, and you have the Chinese businessmen in the audience, and they're all like on the telephone or kind of SMS under the table like this. You know. So one of my friends, the late Henry Lau, if he would come to a talk or I was giving or if I was translating, then I would make him give me his phone beforehand. I would keep it. And he would be sitting there kind of agitated because it was nothing in his hands. So best get used to then leaving then the telephone outside or in a different room or putting it on silence or just switching the thing off. I mean, we survived without telephones, mobile telephones 5-10 years ago, and as useful as they are, then during our time of meditation, and if we could just leave them alone, then that would be to our benefit. And ultimately, everybody says the same thing. What do I get out of meditation? You get what you put in. And we find that the people who shout the loudest, oh, I don't really get anything out of it, are the individuals who are not practicing these 6 key points here. So if we would like to practice meditation in such a way as to really feel the benefit, the stronger the benefit will come a lot stronger in a lot more kind of a tangible or noticeable way, the more we adhere to these 6 points. The fifth point then is to be a moral individual. So again, what does that mean? So here, in terms of perhaps that could be easily explained in terms of the kind of the lifestyle of the yogi. So a yogi then goes to bed early, gets up early, practices asanas and yoga practices, and then meditates very, very easily. If we are an individual who gets into that kind of lifestyle, then great. But then again, perhaps the youngsters amongst us, you know, still kind of the night's kind of young, you know, go out, get really drunk with your friends, come home, and you kind of stagger into bed, and when the alarm clock goes off at 6 o'clock for your morning meditation, you kind of knock it across the room, and even if you do wake up, you know, you're kind of half awake and you're kind of bumping into the door frame as you stumble into the toilet. We've all been there, we've all done it. So here then, the more cleanly our lifestyle, the easier it is to meditate. That's the reasoning. So in terms of doing yoga practice, again, the cleaner our lifestyle, the easier it is to practice. So for example, if you know, like my family in England, they have this kind of insane way of eating, where they don't have any breakfast, and they kind of just abide on a tiny snack at lunchtime, and they have this huge dinner, and wonder why, you know, they settle down to watch this television program they've been waiting to see, and they just kind of fall asleep. And so I'm completely the opposite. And I kind of eat a lot in the morning, and they're all looking at me saying, "Oh, you're completely mad," and nothing in the evening, which kind of drives them up the wall. But at least I get to watch the television program. So in the same way, if you don't eat in the evening, or you eat less in the evening, then when you get up in the morning, you're very, very bright, you're very, very alert. In fact, for us monastics, if we behave well, then we shouldn't eat at all after the noon meal. So what was the Buddha's logic in that? Was not so that we'd all be very thin and trim and kind of what have you, but rather meditation. If you want to really meditate well, then the period of doing it, after lunch you rest a little bit, then in the afternoon you practice it. In the evening when the sun's just setting, you practice walking meditation. Then a little bit of light meditation on the breath, then you go to sleep around, you know, 10 o'clock at night. You wake up at 1:32 in the morning, and then your body is really grounded, your mind is brilliantly alert, and then you meditate through to about 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. Then you exercise, get up from the meditation and go on arms round. That was the Buddha's intention. For the intensity of meditation then, one wouldn't eat after lunch. So in the same way, I'm not suggesting that you stop eating in the evening, by any means. Here in terms of when it says living kind of morally, here what this means is to give yourself the best opportunity for the development of meditation, then the cleaner lifestyle you lead, eating less in the evening, in terms of kind of physical, kind of one should do some exercise, stretretching, but yoga is in terms of ancient Indian tradition. Then of the 8 branches of yoga, for example, asana is one practice, and the point of asana, stretching the leg muscles, etc., is to bring about an intensification of one's meditation. So these things are very useful in this regard. Of course, I'm not suggesting, by any means, I'm not telling you how to lead your lives, but if you are hungover in the mornings and meditation, forget it, it won't work. Likewise, if you eat a lot just before going to bed, and when you wake up in the morning, you'll be really sluggish and down. You don't need to take my word for it, try it for yourself. No, eat like, you know, 5 Big Macs before you go to bed, or, you know, the vegetarian equivalent. And then, you know, when you wake up, and see how you wake up in the morning. And then, alternately, just eat the light snack in the evening and see how you wake up in the morning. So here, we're under the presumption that we would like to make progress here with our meditation. And as such, then, the lighter the meal in the evening, the better the frame of mind within which we go to bed. That is to say, if we meditate just before going to bed, not intensely, but in a relaxed, perhaps watching the breath, just bringing that sense of mindfulness to play, and within that sense of mindfulness, if we go to sleep, the mindfulness sooner or later will start to carry through the dream time. We'll be mindful in the dream and of the dreams, etc. This is something that just comes through being mindful. For example, when we're mindful in the meditation session, we allow the cool-off period to occur. When we get up from the seat to go about our activities, then at that time, slowly, slowly, we'll see then the evidence of mindfulness in our day-to-day lives. And sooner or later, then we'll start to see how we change, how we become more mindful during the day. when we come to the point where we're completely mindful, and depending upon how much time we've invested in the meditation practice, then we'll start to see an intensification of the mindfulness during the 24/7 really. So as such, then giving ourselves the best possible arena or place within which to, or state of mind, if you will, state of being possibly, within which to develop mindfulness, then it develops better. The better the greater the space or the kind of ethical arena within which we give ourselves then the opportunity to practice mindfulness. So that's then the fifth one, and is living this kind of pure lifestyle or moral lifestyle, if you will, within which then we are kind of living not frugally, but rather just giving ourselves then the ability to practice mindfulness and meditation in the morning, giving ourselves the best possible environment within which to develop the practice. Which brings us to the last one then, which is to completely abandon any hopes. And of course, what comes by is the notion of kind of expectation or kind of fear or anxiety, apprehension possibly, about not getting a result within the meditation itself. So when we sit, we should just sit, not with hopes of becoming a great meditator, not with hopes of that blissful, serene, calm experience that I had yesterday. Without any expectation, we should just sit and do the practice. And whatever happens, happens. As the Kadampa masters of the past used to say, whatever happens, happens. Whatever goes away, goes away. So there's no need to do anything. Just sit and meditate. Whatever experience happens, it's neither good nor bad. Just keep on with the practice. This is extremely important advice. And so if we take that to heart, have no expectation. If the thought of expectation arises, and therefore the disturbance to the practice of meditation, then just as you've learned in the mindfulness of the thought process, you're sitting mindfully, just be with that bare awareness, with our bare attention, just looking at the mind itself. And when the thoughts arise, we're mindful of their arising. When we are thinking, we are mindful of the thought process, and then we're mindful of letting it go. We're not clinging to it, we're not entertaining it, like the example of the traveling door-to-door salesman. When he knocks on the door, or dentist, when he knocks on the door saying, do you want to buy a feather duster or have any teeth pulled? At that point you just say, not opening the door, not even going to entertain you. Because once that door's open and he starts talking, then you're not going to get rid of them. And you try to slam the door, but the foot's in the door, and it becomes a big battle. So I don't know if that's the same in Israel, but it certainly used to be like that in England. I remember as a boy, open the door and it's like, oh no, my mother would say, and she would shut the door, and the guy's like, well, the big boot in the door, and you're trying to shut it, and he's like, how about one of these? So anyway, when the thoughts or expectation arises, let it go. Before we sit down, we think, I'm going to have a really good meditation session, I've placed the flowers just right, the incense smells really great, forget it. Just sit down and meditate for the sake of meditation. Wishing to develop it, having thought about the benefits of developing it, when we sit down to meditate, then we're just going to, as the Nike advert says, we're going to just do it. No need of anything, just do it. We know how to do it, and we're going to do it. Which leads us then to the practice of meditation. In this case then, we're going to look at the sadhana here, which is the treasury of blessing, which is... So with those 6 points, the question arises, when you just sit down to meditate, as you've been saying, what should our attitude be? And so, as Kyabjidingo Kinzo Rinpoche kind of writes, in this opening to his abbreviation or condensed version of Mipham's book of quotes from the sutras, the word of the Buddha, on the practice of shamatha and vipassana. Within this kind of introduction, then, Rinpoche mentions one should. One should think about the Buddha, think about the qualities of the Buddha. And these can be learned from the biography of the Buddha, principally then the 12 Ds, which we're going to. The 12 Ds of the Buddha, they're not all that important, but some are more important than others. And hopefully in the next couple of days we'll have the opportunity to go through them all, and thereby bring a sense of wonderment towards the Buddha. And also think that by remembering or bringing to mind the Buddha, one, as is written in the beginning of this sadhana. Sadhana means then method of accomplishing. So here we're going to accomplish then the Buddha by meditating upon the Buddha. As it says here, whilst walking, sitting, standing or sleeping, whoever thinks of the moon-like Buddha, the Buddha is always in front of him or her, and he or she will attain nirvana, the vast nirvana. So here in the Samadhi Raja Sutta, which is the word of the Buddha, it talks about the four different ways that one can meditate, either walking, sitting down, standing up, or lying down, leading to sleeping. Whoever thinks of the moon-like Buddha, the Buddha is always in front of him, and he or she will attain the vast nirvana. So here one remembers the Buddha as a source of inspiration and also as the teacher of the Dharma. And the Dharma here is for a Buddhist practitioner then the actual refuge. But the Buddha then is the person who's perfected said refuge. So when we see the Buddha, the teacher of refuge, he is also an individual who embodies it. So when we look at the picture which you have in front of you, we shouldn't just see a golden image of a man sitting cross-legged. Rather, this is the image of the fully enlightened one, the Buddha, the kind of result of the Dharma path, the ultimate in terms of spiritual accomplishment, and by the by, the ultimate in terms of the cessation of dissatisfaction and suffering. So the end, if you like, the result of the spiritual path. So again, the quality of the Buddha we're going to discuss over the next couple of days, albeit in brief, and then hopefully you can, if you have a sense of wonderment towards Buddha or what Buddha is, then we can find out more by looking into the various explanations of the life of the Buddha. But really, the way we get to know the Buddha or what Buddha is through then his teaching. So here, when we talk about the Buddha is always in front of him and he will attain the vast nirvana, what this refers to then is the teachings, the embodiment of the teachings, and is the Buddha. So remembering or thinking of the Buddha then is the inspiration to engage in the practice of meditation and there through the digesting process of the teaching of the Buddha which comes thereby. His pure body is the color of gold, utterly beautiful in every way, is the protector of the world. To visualize him like this is to meditate like the bodhisattvas. So here then the bodhisattvas are those individuals who are on the greater vehicle, spiritual path, who meditate then upon the qualities of the Buddha, personified by the form of the Buddha, the description of which is going to be given in this kind of manual. So the sadhana then is like the way of, or the means of, or the method of meditating then upon the form of the Buddha. And so in terms of this particular meditation then, it's one within which we are going to use a visualized object, and we're going to focus upon it, and thereby develop a concentration or a stilling of the mind, leading then to the ultimate accomplishment of the perfectly qualified or the fully qualified meditation, which is known as calm abiding. And in a nutshell then, calm abiding is a state of mind within which one has perfect physical and mental pliancy and is able to focus one's mind on any object for hours and hours on end. So if we practice meditation, in terms of duration, even if we get a partial way towards achieving that calm abiding, we could meditate for hours, although that's not the end of the path. In terms of duration then, if you would like to meditate for a long time, provided of course we have a stable basis, firm foundation if you will, then the duration comes really rather quickly. But it's the quality that's important. So I want to emphasize that, as I did last weekend, right from the beginning, the quality of the meditation in the early stages and leading then into the later stages far exceeds the duration or the time with which we spend meditating on a particular object. So please bring that or bear that in mind. There are no prizes for trying to outdo your neighbor in terms of duration. Here it's the quality which is important rather than then the quantity of time or the duration. So Kenzin Rinpoche, again in his introduction, goes on to remind us that having the opportunity then to meditate upon the form of the Buddha, we should do so. We shouldn't squalor such a chance. He goes on to say that, you know, the dharma of making offerings at temples is okay, but it's really then the development of the qualities of the dharma in terms of the spiritual path, which leads then to the ultimate cessation. So for the Buddhist then, when we see experience as ultimately dissatisfying, one would like to get rid of that by removing it from its very root. So that which removes the dissatisfaction or the experience of dissatisfaction from its root is then this thing which is known as the actual Dharma, which is the spiritual path, leading then to the stopping or the cessation of that dissatisfaction. So for the Buddhist then, meditation is a key tool in the uprooting of these kind of afflictions or these kind of disturbing emotions. And is, as such, it's like, for example, in the garden, when you want to kind of remove weeds, etc., you need to use a trowel and various other kind of scythe and various other implements. So in the same way, the Buddhist then, in order to uproot and remove these kind of weed-like mental afflictions or disturbing emotions, then we use the tools which are afforded us by then the practice of meditation. So meditation is an extremely important tool, and thus then the development, learning how to develop it, learning how to wield or to use it, is likewise extremely important. So we're encouraged then to spend our time contemplating the teaching of the Buddha and then putting it into practice through developing then the perfect tool for said development, which is then perfectly qualified shamatha meditation or calm abiding meditation, which also then serves as the tool or that which causes said uprooting of those disturbing emotions, which is known then as the higher seeing. So this vipassana, this higher seeing, comes about from within meditation. So the stronger we can say our meditation, the greater effect the wielding of the tool and of higher seeing or vipassana becomes, and there through the easier it is to uproot those or get rid of those kind of disturbing states of mind. So bearing this in mind, the sadhana goes on with a description of what we are going to meditate upon. So this is really easy. All you really need to do is just look at the picture in front of you. But for those of us, you know, who want to read something, as a magical display, the union of unborn emptiness and the unceasing manifestation of interdependent origination. So the syllable which is written here as "ah," can be understood in two ways. Three possibly. Ah, you can think of something very cute or very nice, so that you kind of say, ah, isn't that sweet? Or secondly, ah, as in kind of the utterance you might have as you relax after a hard day's kind of work or a hard day's toil. Or ah, as it's intended here, which is then the perfection of wisdom in a single syllable. So for those kind of who have understood, as it mentions here, the union of unborn emptiness and interdependent origination, or emptiness, shunyata, if you will, then at this point we bring to mind whatever understanding or realization of emptiness we have. If we have none, then at this point at least we bring to mind the notion of it as embodied in these words. As a magical display, the union of unborn emptiness and the unceasing manifestation of interdependent origination. In either way, it doesn't really matter, because what follows on is the visualization process. So here, visualize in front of oneself infinite clouds of offerings in the sky. in the middle of which, upon a jeweled lion throne, Lotus Sun and Moon is the incomparable teacher, the lion of the Shakyas, Shakyamuni Buddha. The colour of gold, endowed with the major and minor marks, wearing the three Dharma robes and seated in the Vajra posture. His right hand is in the gesture of touching the earth, his left hand, in the mudra, or hand gesture, if you will, of equanimity, holds an alms bowl filled with nectar. He shines in splendor and majesty like a golden mountain. His wisdom filling space in a plexus of rays of light, he is surrounded by infinite retinues, hosts of exalted beings, the 8 close sons, the 16 Shravakas, and the like. On those who merely think of him, he bestows complete liberation from the two extremes of samsara and nirvana, the glory of supreme bliss. Visualize him as the great being who embodies all the objects of refuge. So, in a nutshell, you have the picture in front of you. That's what you visualize. Simple, right? So, of course, Tibetans like to make things complicated. So you have these notions of big clouds filled with offerings and surrounded by a host of exalted beings, the 8 close sons, which refers to then the 8 bodhisattvas, such as Chenrezig, Samadabhadra, Manjushri, Samadabhadra, and what have you. And the 16 Shravakas refers to Bakula and the other kind of 16 great arhats. And so that gets things really complicated, because then you've got one person in the middle and then 16 over there, and then there's 8 there, and there's loads of clouds everywhere. And aren't we going to get distracted by the sheer volume of things to visualize? So in my humble opinion, when you are learning to practice shamatha meditation, the object which we are focusing upon is Shakyamuni Buddha. So in terms of when we learn to meditate, it is said that as we've read in the beginning, bringing the Buddha to mind brings about incredible kind of blessing. And how that occurs is through bringing to mind the inspiration or sense of wonderment that the Buddhist feels towards the teacher, the Buddha. Because as is mentioned in the last sentence here, the great being who embodies all the objects of refuge. So we think of the Buddha. The more we get to know the three kind of Vajras, or the three parts, composites, if you will, of the Buddha, the kind of mind which is the ultimate cessation, which is thoroughly kind of beyond any kind of a disturbance, and has all kind of qualities, imaginable qualities. The mind then is Buddha, the speech then is the Dharma then refers to the teaching of the Buddha. So obviously, the principal mode of instruction, although there are exceptions, the principal mode of giving teachings is verbally. So we would say then the speech of the Buddha, the verbalization, if you will, of the intention or the wisdom, if you will, of the Buddha is the speech. And such then the speech is the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha. And then the form which we interact with is then the Sangha jewel, the spiritual friend who helps us to practice the teachings. So that's when we visualize in the Buddha, as it says here, the embodiment of the three all objects of refuge, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So we're viewing the Buddha physically as the Sangha, a spiritual friend, who helps us in practicing his teachings then, which are the Dharma. And of course in the mind of said individual is then the Buddha, one which is at one time completely awakened from the slumber confusion and ignorance, and is fully awake and endowed with every conceivable quality. And thus then is the definition of a Buddha, someone who's awakened completely from the slumber of confusion and is at the same time endowed with every conceivable quality. So that's the meaning of a Buddha, the awakened one, the enlightened one, the fully enlightened one, depending on how you like to say it or how you like to translate it. But in a nutshell, we're trying to visualize this image of the Buddha. Which brings us then to the next point. There's a lot of kind of talks about the benefits of visualizing the Buddha, but we can look at those later on. The question then arises, how do we visualize? And if we learn to visualize, or if we can do it for a moment, but then we lose it, how do we sustain that visualization? So this is a very valid point, and it's one which we can address on the following level. If you want to learn to visualize images Here we're principally focusing on the Buddha. In the Theravada tradition, for example, in the Path of Purification, the meditation manual known as the Path of Purification, it teaches us to focus upon spheres of light. And depending on our particular aptitude, they could be yellow, red, white, blue, or green. It doesn't really matter. Depending on what we like, what sits well with us. We also learn in the early stages to focus with our eyes on a particular object. Like, for example, in the meditation manual, The Ocean of Certainty, it teaches us then to look at different objects, like a stick, for example, and then perhaps a stone. But all the time we're just looking at it with our eyes. And that just serves as a method of quietening the mind. So if we are, in the, according to that manual, the Ocean of Certainty, if our mind is particularly jumpy, full of thought, then we just look at an object, something which is not particularly attractive. We're not going to be too attracted towards it. By the by, we're not going to be too averse to it. Like this packet of tissues, for example. I could just put it in front of myself and just look at it, just stare at it. And when the thought to move comes away, I just bring my awareness back to it. If I fall asleep, I wake myself up and just look at it. Keep focus till the motion of thought, till the thought process subsides somewhat. So here, we are going to initially use the image of the Buddha, and we are going to look at it with our eyes. We're going to put it in terms of when you go home, of course, it'd be difficult to do now, unless you have some sellotape and you stick it to the back of the person sitting in front of you. We're back of their head, possibly. We're going to then, when we get home, the place to put the image is at the level of the eyes in front of you. And the place where you're going to visualize the image is at the same level, the level of the brow, about 5-6 feet in front of you. We're going to imagine the image about, you know, again, it depends on you, it depends on your disposition. Perhaps it may be just an inch or so, perhaps it'll be, you know, 5-6 inches, or somewhere in between. It depends on you, what size works for you. But in the early stages, don't do it too small, and don't do it too big. Again, this middle way. Neither too big nor too small. Just right. So when we focus on the image of the Buddha, how are we going to bring about said visualization? Visualization, when we kind of use that word, it brings to mind this esoteric notion that we're doing something really special. But visualization is something we do all the time. For those of you, you know, if you lived in the United States, or you've been in places where, or you've seen on the television in the United States when they're trying to sell, you know, the real estate agent is trying to sell you a house, and the house is somewhat run down, and they take you out the back and they say, visualize what you could do with this place. I can just visualize you having this kind of barbecue over there. Visualize the pool with the kids playing and some duck or something on the side. And visualize what this bedroom could look like. And, you know, the place is horrible, there's graffiti on the walls, and it's kind of rats in the corner. Visualize that everything's really nice. And you're kind of like, oh yeah, see what. We do it all the time. When we daydream of things, how we would like to see ourselves, the image comes up very clearly. Perhaps we see ourselves as some kind of great individual, kind of great, you know, someone who's kind of done something really good, or someone who's gotten something they really want, or we dream about getting something. For example, whatever you like, perhaps a new item of clothing, and we think to ourselves, when I've got that, I'll look like this. When I walk down the road, people will look at me like that. And the whole scenario is playing out in our mind, and we're seeing it really clearly. Likewise, when we remember a loved one, we think of, you know, perhaps a parent, partner, friend, and their face comes to mind very vividly, and we're able to look at it. And we notice that in the moment when we look at that face, it doesn't really change, because it's a photograph, if you like. It's a picture painted within the mind's eye. But what we also notice is that as it arose, it quickly departs again. So what we're going to try and do is bring up the image of the Buddha within the mind's eye. And this will be very, very detailed, because we're going to get very, very familiar with it. And the way of getting familiar with it is initially then by looking at it. So in terms of working with visual images, then as one of the famous sculptors, it may be Michelangelo, but I can't remember, said whilst looking at a lump of marble, "I'm working." And what was Michelangelo, was it? And when he was asked by the person who commissioned him to make a sculpture, he said, "No, I'm paying you by the hour. What are you doing just sitting around here? You should be kind of there with hammer and chisel." And he said, "Leave me alone, I'm working." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I'm looking at the parts I need to take away to reveal the statue." So in the same way, when we learn the visualization process, it can be very, very handy at the beginning. We look at the image. We look at all the nooks and the crannies of the image of the Buddha. The face, the ears, the Ushnisha, which as Robert Thurman calls it, the extra scoop of brains on the top. And then there's the golden torso, the right arm, the left arm, the legs, golden color, the seat. And it's not something which is flat like the photograph. It's not something which is like heavy, three-dimensional like a statue. Rather, the way we're going to visualize it in our minds is something like a hologram. Like the meditation manuals will say, vividly clear, yet intangible, like a rainbow. So in the same way, we're going to bring to mind this image of the Buddha. So we look at it, look at the different details of the image, then close our eyes slightly, bring it, force the image to come up, then hold it there. And then it goes away quickly. And perhaps if we can't bring it up again, go back to looking at the picture. And then closing our eyes, forcing the image of the Buddha, remembering it. Of course, this isn't going to come easily. And perhaps we can have one of two experiences. One is that we can't really get the details. Rather, what appears is this gold blob, like an egg possibly, or a teardrop, with golden color, and it's just this lump in front of us. Then that's great. As in the example of then the Michelangelo, if it is he, and the statue, or as the Kampas and people from Eastern Tibet say, if you get your hands on something, then you can work out the details. So in the same way, if we get a hold of this golden kind of blob or this golden egg shape or teardrop shape in front of us, then we can start to work with the details, looking at the face, remembering the face, remembering the neck, remembering the torso, remembering the right hand, the left hand, the legs, etc. We can bring the details to mind. Or, on the other hand, when we bring the image to mind, perhaps we can't get the whole, but we just get one part of it. Perhaps the right eye, the left eye, the extra scoop of brains, whatever. But if we can get a hold on it, if we can get our grips on it, then the rest of it comes later, rather like taming a wild horse. If we've got our lasso around it, it might be all over the place, but we've still got a hold, haven't we? So in the same way, when we look at the image, just a part of the image comes to mind, and just focus on that. And the way of focusing is like if you're trying to tame a wild horse. You don't hold it too tight, and you don't hold it too slack. If you hold it too tight, it becomes very uncomfortable. If you hold it too slack, it'll run away. So the key to the visualization process is one, familiarity. Being familiar with the image so that when it comes to mind, you can focus on it and you can hold it. Like the example of somebody holding a wild horse. Now the way of holding it, and this is something that you have to find out for yourself. Even if the Dalai Lama was in front of you, Buddha Shakyamuni would say the same thing. Neither too tight nor too loose. In terms of where that middle way comes, it's entirely up to you. We all have different constituencies. As such, as I mentioned earlier, when sitting, trying to sit in the seven-point posture, the effect that the body has on the mind is definitely tangible. And the more sensitive you or in tune that you become with that, then again, in terms of meditating, you can really adjust the meditation through adjusting the physical side of things. So in terms of focusing upon this image in front of us, what we're trying to do at one time then is to have it vividly appear in the mind. Now in terms of how tight or how loosely we hold it can depend upon how we're sitting, but primarily it depends upon our mind being focused on the object. And so, you know, for example, meditation manuals which talk about the technical way of achieving then meditation on a focused object, they talk about taming the mind, and there's a pictorial kind of account of how one does that. And so then kind of mindfulness and introspection are that which holds then the one's kind of focus on said image. And the mind is likened to this elephant. Initially you have to catch it with an iron hook. So in ancient India then you would have this big long pole with a big iron hook on the top, and you would catch the elephant round its ear. And then you would slowly kind of get the elephant to kind of, you know, submit to your kind of whims. You would tame the elephant. Or, for example, perhaps something which is closer to home, possibly, a lasso, where you kind of lasso a kind of wild horse. So you kind of get a hold of it somehow. Although possibly then the example with the iron hook is better, because, you know, our attention falls off the object, then we have to put it back. It falls off, and we have to put it back. If you're lassoed, you're kind of stuck. Although if the kind of horse can shake off the lasso, then that's something else. But anyway, whatever works for us, the ideal then is that the focal point is the image of the Buddha. The way of getting used to it is by looking at it. Looking at it, closing our eyes, remembering it. Opening our eyes slightly in the meditation session, bringing to mind the image of the Buddha. It's in front of us. It doesn't mean that it's on top of the person in front of your head. That's the reason, really, for bringing about the notion of emptiness in the initial stages. We're not bothered by what's in the room. We're focusing primarily on the image of the Buddha. Through reflecting emptiness, what comes through that reflection or through that understanding is the notion that nothing really exists inherently. And as such, things only kind of take on that dimension when we give them our attention. We get involved in the object, so to speak. So here we're not going to be bothered by external objects. We're internalizing, and in terms of the visualization process, that is to say then, bringing up the image of the Buddha, which we painted within our mind's eye. We're placing it in front of us, and we're going to focus on it. And as such, then, in the early stages of this visualization process, we're looking at the picture, putting it down, trying to remember it. And then, slowly, what we'll get is this familiarity with the image as a whole or a part of it. And then we just focus on that. And then relax, keeping the image in mind, but without focusing intensely upon it. And then letting it go. Focusing, letting it go. Focused, letting it go. Rather like when we were mindful of the breath. We're mindful of the breath, relax. We don't fall out of the practice. So in the same way, the intensity of focusing on the image, then we relax. But our attention is still there in the back of our mind. There's the mindfulness of the image visualized in front of ourselves. Rather like, you know, if we put the washing machine on, there's something, or the dishwasher, there's something in the back of our minds telling us that the thing's ticking over, even though we're not sitting in front of it, listening to it, whirring around. So in the same way, we just leave the image there in front of us and we relax. Focus on it intensely. If we lose the image completely, look at the picture. If we have a picture in front of us, we look at it with our eyes. Then, close our eyes, bring the image to mind, open the eyes slightly, and then we meditate upon it. Try to bring it to mind. And no matter what happens, we're not distracted. We're just placing our attention on the image of the Buddha. That's our focus. We lose it, put it back on. Lose it, put it back on. Lose it, put it back on. All manner of thoughts arise, sending our consciousness all over the place. Never mind, put it back on. That's the instruction here. Bring the image to mind and then focus upon it. So the image... I didn't say anything about the Buddha. any questions? I'll have to start talking about the Buddha a little bit, I suppose, but just for 5 minutes, is there any question about how the visualization practice works? So tomorrow morning, in the meditation session, at that point, firstly, if you can sit down, and in all meditation sessions, here is a time to get familiar. So sit down, remember those 7 points as we went through last week. The person leading the meditation will go through that tomorrow morning, as they will throughout the weekend, bring to mind those 7 points. Meditate on the breath, get yourself relaxed, comfortable. Then bring to mind the image of the Buddha. If you need just to look at it like this, put it down, close your eyes, bring the image to mind, and focus on it. Remember about the level of the brow, about 6 feet in front of you, and again between the size of 1 and 6 inches. It's vividly clear, yet intangible, like a rainbow. And remember, when we read the description, if we feel we need to do it, again and again, the point is familiarization with the words. All the words are doing, it's like the words of a book. They just bring about an image within the mind. So when we recite this, the point of reflection on emptiness at the beginning is to do away with any interest in external objects. Our mind ceases to go out to something else inherently in front of us. We reflect on its emptiness. Within that, then, we bring to mind the image of the Buddha. Within then, the notion of unborn emptiness and the unceasing manifestation of interdependent origination, which means the mind, basically. So within then, the mind, in the mind's eye, primarily, if you will, we're going to paint the image of the Buddha with the oil and brushes of familiarity. And then we're going to focus upon that image. And when we lose it, we bring it back. If it's a gross image, like of a golden egg or a kind of golden teardrop shape, then work at revealing, as in Michelangelo's case, the statue from within the granite. If we can only focus on one part of it, then, like the taming of an elephant or of a wild horse, hold on to that one point and then slowly develop the rest around it, as if you're building an image using kind of blocks, you know, like kind of kids with Lego, you know. You get one part and then you slowly build on it and build until you've got this huge monstrosity in front of you. So again, this is the way of practicing through familiarity. Now, in terms of ability to meditate or to visualize, as I said, those kind of words bring about the notion that it's really something extraordinary. It's not. It's something we do all the time when we daydream, when we imagine what we look like in certain clothes, how we see ourselves. It's all using process of visualization or the visualization tool, if you will. And as such, then, when we focus upon it, on this image, or start to generate the idea of the Buddha within our mind, the real thing then, or the real trick here, is sustaining the image. The visualization process is something we've all done, it's something which we're all very familiar with. It's just a matter of getting used to it. So, as I mentioned earlier, and as I mentioned again now, meditation is nothing magical, mysterious. It's something very simple, very straightforward, very earthy, very organic, and very grounded. Same with the practice of visualization. Something that we just need to get used to a little bit. So as I mentioned, if there's one or two questions. Okay, moving on. Nothing today, tomorrow. It's on the back page. If you want to, if you're fascinated, it's on page 4. Yeah. No, you need both. You need both. Not at the same time, but you need both. Because as I say, when you look at the image and you look at the details of it, so when you just look at the image, you're looking at the whole thing, then you look at the details when you go into the image and you look at the shape of the eyes, the ears, the head, the torso, the, you know, the arms, the what have you. So you need both, to be focused on the whole, and then then to reveal the details, like the granite, and then kind of removing that to allow the statue to appear. In the same way, if you look at the whole, then you can slowly focus on the different parts that comprise the whole. Likewise, if you can just focus on one part, for example, what the right eye. If you just focus on that, that's the only bit that comes clearly to mind. Then just keep your attention on that. It's an anchor at least. And then slowly, like Lego, you know, you build the rest around that. So again, this will, you know, will manifest in different ways according to your own constitution, to your own kind of how you think, how your mind works, etc. But in either way, what we need is then the familiarity that comes with looking at the image of the Buddha. Okay, so as it's one of the four kind of special days in the Tibetan in the lunar calendar, so today is then, for some mad reason, is the we didn't plan this. So today is the what's known as the special occasion, or the great celebration of the turning of the Dharma wheel. So it's when the anniversary of when, over 2,500 years ago, that the Buddha gave a teaching on the Four Noble Truths for the first time. And so it seems quite auspicious that this that for Dharma friends, at least, that we're speaking about the Buddha on this day, and this is also then one of the first of this kind of ongoing program which you have, known as this Buddhism A to Z. So it's, I think, kind of auspicious beginning, which probably came about because of our teacher's blessing. And so as such, then, on this day, then I should say something, at least the beginning of the biography of the Buddha. So as I mentioned, there's a notion of 12 deeds in the life story of Shakyamuni Buddha. Certain scholars mention that this is perhaps not really how things were, but rather it's a Jain way of looking at a person's life, which may be the case. But nevertheless, that the key elements running through the story are universal. They're universal to Shakyamuni Buddha, and they're universal thereafter to all who wanted to perfect spirituality based upon that, the teachings which Shakyamuni gave. So if we look at Shakyamuni Buddha in light of the activity of him, now not in terms of a soul which is kind of unchanging and going from life to lifetime, but rather in terms of a changing of being, or a changing of mind, of consciousness, if you will, and how the evolution of that over a period of time. So as it is said in the historical accounts, aeons ago. So what is an aeon, first of all, right? So an aeon is something in terms of years. If you think of a year, 1 year, and then you change that one to a nine, so 9 years. Then after that nine, you put 27 zeros. And that's the kind of life, that's the kind of span of time we're looking at. So it's quite long, isn't it? So anyway, many of them ago, there was an individual called Shakyamuni, who was an awakened one, a Buddha. So Buddha is not limited to this time frame, to Shakyamuni Buddha. Buddha is just a manifestation of kind of how things are. So there was an individual known as Shakyamuni Buddha, and he had a little boy come to him. And this boy was amazed by the form of the Buddha. He said, as we read in the various descriptions, that his kind of body kind of almost radiated kind of golden light. And he had these kind of some things which we can see rather easily, like the apparently on his the palms of his hands there were kind of wheels, the soles of his feet there are also wheels. Apparently when he walked he was always like 1 inch off the ground. And he wasn't wearing heels either. And had these very long earlobes and this kind of extra scoop of brains and all these things. But anyway, he looked really kind of odd actually, but anyway, he looked really extraordinary. And so anyway, there was this deity known as Shakyamuni, this being, rather, this Buddha known as Shakyamuni. And there was a little boy who went before him, they're all Indian in India, I mean, so anyway, a boy that went before him anyway, and looked at him and said, "You're really something extraordinary. I really want to be like you. Not only like you, I want to be you. I want to have your name and your looks and everything." And in the praise of the Buddha, he said that he praised the one who, through that aspiration, came to be known when he was enlightened himself by the same name as that Buddha all those aeons ago, who was known as Shakyamuni. So this, the mind stream of this individual, or the consciousness, if you will, of this individual, then slowly developed. And it is said that this person became a very decent individual, a good person, if you like. Oops. And what happened ultimately was he gave rise to this really caring attitude and loving attitude. But nevertheless, he wasn't completely without demerit. It is said that at one point he must have done something very nasty, because according to the narrative, he was reborn in one of those hellish existences. Interesting, if the hell realms exist or not, who knows? What we do know, if we look historically in this world system, is that somehow, without use of internet, telephones, any kind of fast communication, we find from prehistoric times to around 13th, 14th century images of these kind of terrifying types of existence, which are usually depicted in flame in, you know, prehistoric cave paintings, North America, South America, China, Tibet, India, Middle East, Europe. There's no connection between them all, but nevertheless, mystics or people who are possibly a little bit more far-sighted had the notion that these terrible places existed. These places where there was nothing but pain, dissatisfaction. And perhaps the way that depicts that best is somebody living in flame, where you have that sensation of burning all the time. And not only that, one is beaten within it. According to Buddhism, then, this is all then the manifestation of one's negative action. Through then doing negative or nasty things, then one is responsible for one's own experience. So in the same way, when we view these hellish existences, we shouldn't think that they are places where we are sent by somebody other than ourselves, but rather that they are just then the manifestation of some nasty deed that we've done. So as the saying goes, kind of be good, do good. Anyhow, going back to the narrative, then Shakyamuni, the person who was to become Shakyamuni Buddha was in this particular existence. And the description is that he and his friend were kind of within this flamish or this kind of hellish type of existence, were being driven. They were pulling a chariot, and sitting on the chariot was this kind of demon who was whipping them both. And Shakyamuni's friend, you know, was in extreme, as they both were, in extreme kind of pain. But at one point, he became so cognition, so concerned about his friend, that he turned to this kind of demon and said, "Just leave him alone. I will pull the chariot myself. Just leave that person alone." And he said, no, I have to beat both of you." And he said, no, if you want to, you can give me twice the amount of beating, but just leave him alone." And he said, at which point then the demon became so mad with the person for having such a caring and compassionate attitude, that he hit him in the head with the butt of the whip, at which point he died and was immediately born because of having that attitude. That is to say, that attitude was the cause of his being born in a pleasant situation in the realm of kind of humans and gods, according to the technical approach, a nice place, in other words. That was when the Bodhisattva was born, so to speak. That was when this notion of extreme compassion, was willing to do anything to alleviate the suffering of others, was born in the person who was to become Shakyamuni Buddha. And it is said that that individual gave rise to this notion that they would do anything to bring about the full enlightenment of each and every sentient being without wishing for fame, gain, praise, blame, whatever. Really just with the concern to be of service to others, giving rise to this strong, this extreme, if you will, of compassion, which is the driving force then of those who would like to become Buddha. So throughout Buddhism, whichever tradition of Buddhism we look at, there's a notion of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva then is one who is intent on becoming Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings, and all of their activity, whether it is physical, verbal or mental, is geared towards this ultimate awakening, so as to be then of benefit in the awakening of each and every sentient being. Thus then is the motivation or the driving force, the fuel, if you will, which moves the Bodhisattvas on their kind of spiritual journey towards Buddhahood. So for the person who was to become Shakyamuni Buddha, then he worked at this task for three of these kind of countless aeons. Remember going back to our letter number 9 with the 27 zeros afterwards? Well, three of those. Three of those then he engaged in various activities. If we look at the narrative known as the Jatakamala or the birth stories, therein we can see then some of the experiences of the person who was to become Shakyamuni, what he in particular times as a pauper engaged in, and certain other times as students of Buddhas, how he served the teachers, and certain other times when he was a king, what he gave up, at other times when he was a merchant, how he benefited others, how he gave his life time and time again, just to bring about the temporary and then leading to then the ultimate welfare of others. So they trained in this extreme, if you will, of compassion for three countless aeons. And it is said that before he took birth as a Shakyamuni Buddha, then he was abiding in what is known as one of these kind of Buddhist hangouts, known as the Pure Land of the Joyful Place. And therein he used to teach everybody. All the people who were there are kind of a select group of individuals who are bodhisattvas on the what are known as the spiritual grounds. These individuals who kind of simultaneously see emptiness and dependent arising all the time. And so those individuals seeing it either directly or through the medium of illusion then can see then the Buddha continually receive instruction, meditation instruction from the Buddha, which they put into practice with the Buddha, sitting with the Buddha. So in this arena, then Shakyamuni, or the person who was to become Shakyamuni then, arose one day. This is the description. Arose one day and said, according to the technical jargon, saw with his unimpeded vision that people in Jambudvipa, India in other words, were ready to be awakened. And so he would voluntarily take birth there to cause or to bring about their kind of awakening. At which point then he didn't leave. He wasn't kind of running away from his duties. He rather appointed a successor, just as, for example, when the dean of a university retires and he appoints his successor before he retires, then Shakyamuni gave the teaching throne and the teaching crown to Maitreya Buddha. It's important just to injuncture at the moment. Apparently, in this 27-0, this aeon that we are in now, which is called a fortunate one, why is it fortunate? Because apparently, at this time frame, there will be 1,000 Buddhas. And all of those have been predicted, including their names, their activities, where they will do, what they will do, etc. It has all been predicted by Shakyamuni Buddha in a sutra, which is known as the Fortunate Aeon, the Sutra of the Fortunate Aeon. So within that sutra then, Shakyamuni Buddha is the fourth person to achieve enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, and his successor will be Maitreya Buddha. So symbolic of that lineage of Buddhas, so to speak. And here, in terms of Buddha, many people are Buddha. We can say that from Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching until now, many people have become enlightened, have become Buddha. What then you may wonder is the significance of Shakyamuni appointing his successor. So here, in terms of the supreme emanation of the Buddha, this is the individual who engages precisely for the first time in any given time period in these 12 deeds. Not somebody who follows thereafter, but rather in a period where there's no Buddha and there's no manifest teaching of the Buddha, the individual comes along and starts it all off by engaging in these 12 deeds, and they're known as the supreme emanation of the Buddha. The supreme emanation of the Buddha. And so Shakyamuni is the fourth, Maitreya will be the fifth, and there will be 1,000. That's not to say that there won't be many, many Buddhas in between, people who become enlightened through practicing the teaching of the Buddha. So there's the emphasis, people who become Buddha or become enlightened through practicing the teaching. If we do it well, there's no reason that why any of us in this room can't become Buddha. Perhaps some of you already are Buddha, Israeli Buddha, why not? So here, the significance then of passing the teaching crown, the teaching throne to Maitreya, was this to say, you are the successor. And so now, Shakyamuni Buddha is going to take kind of birth. That's the first deed, is how you imagine it. Basically what happened is, Shakyamuni Buddha in this kind of Buddhist hangout, passed on the teaching crown, kind of gave his job to Maitreya, and then passed away and was reborn as the son of Maya, who was his mother. And his father was then the king of the Sakya clan. And so, in terms of the moving of consciousness, if you will, from one place to another, the second deed is of the entering of the consciousness into the womb of the mother. So it is said then that his mother dreamt on the night of his conception, Maya dreamt of a white elephant with 6 tusks entering into her stomach. And thereafter, according to the poem which I was reading earlier of Asvaghosha, and also according to the Pali suttas, within which you find all these amazing things happen to her. Well, anyway, the be-all or end-all is that she was pregnant. And she had nice dreams and kind of nice, pleasant experience of being pregnant. And of course, after 10 months, according to the Indian tradition, 10 months, perhaps 9, 9.5 months, who knows. But according then to the traditional account, after 10 months, or just before rather, 10 months had came about, as was the tradition in India, that the pregnant wife would return to her mother's home to give birth in the family house. And so then the Queen Maya went home to her family estate. Now the place where she lived with Shodhana, the king of the Sakya clan, was in a place which is known as
Kapilavastu.
And where is Kapilavastu? Nepal. So there's a region of northeastern India, Kapilavastu, which is an area which is, the borders of which have been long lost. The area was originally known as Magga, that was the state, if you like. And within that, Kapilavastu was one of the prosperous cities within which Shodhana reigned. Now this was a huge area. India at this time was a very advanced civilization. And the kind of border between, as we were joking just now, between India and Nepal wasn't fixed. So Queen Maya was on her way home, and she was at a place which is now known as Lumbini, and apparently on the route to her family estate, her water broke and contraction started, and she gave birth in a park. So it is said then that during the trip home, that she couldn't make it all the way home, but rather in this grove, and she gave birth to the one who was to be known as Shakyamuni. So it's getting late, so I'll leave it just at that point, the birth of the Buddha, and then we'll describe what happened afterwards tomorrow. So in the meditation in the morning, please try to ground yourself in the seven-point posture. Breathe, feel relaxed, and at the same time kind of alert. And within that relaxed alertness, bring to mind the image of the Buddha. If you can't bring it to mind, look at it, close your eyes, bring to mind the image, open your eyes slightly, and then meditate upon it. And that way, just try to hold the image in mind. Again, if it's just a blob, a golden blob, or if it is just a part that makes up the whole, like an eye, the nose, or whatever, just focus upon that and try to sustain the amount of time that you are kind of focused upon it. And as in the example of holding either a taming hook, which is around the elephant's ear, or a lasso, which is around a lasso, which is around the neck of a wild horse, one holds it not too tight, but not too slack either. So in just the same way, when you focus on the image, not too tight, but also not too loose. Because either way, you'll lose the image. And so with that, then let's kind of finish here this evening. And if you can recite the, as accordance with the Buddhist tradition, if there's been any merit, as we've been speaking about the Buddha, the name of the Buddha a little bit, maybe there's something. Then if you can recite then the dedication prayers in Hebrew. Jambalabhavita.